Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia, this is CJSF 90.1 FM.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
How does writing a memoir change and expand our lives? Those who have done so tell us that writing our own story is a way of making meaning in our life and the world. It will reveal themes, patterns, and turning points in our life. In fact, we may even find compassion even for those who have done us harm. Of course, we'd love for our memoir to be on the bestseller list, but there are many reasons to consider giving paper and pen to our life story. Today, we'll explore the many benefits and challenges of writing our own life story with our guest, Brenda Peterson. Brenda Peterson is an author and a teacher of writing. Her work has appeared in the New York Times and many other newspapers and magazines, including Orion, Sierra, and Oprah. A dedicated advocate for the conservation of ocean mammals, she has authored 16 books, including Build Me an Ark, as well as Duck and Cover, which was recognized by the New York Times as a notable book of the year. Peterson's second memoir is a bit of a dark yet divine comedy entitled I Want to Be Left Behind, Finding Rapture Here on Earth. Brenda Peterson resides on the banks of the Salish Sea in Seattle, Washington. Join us for the next hour as we explore the soul work of telling our life stories with our guest, Brenda Peterson. My name is Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Brenda, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me back, Justine.
It's just great to sit with you once again. I love the book. It was fun. It was delightful. It was insightful. And I wanted to ask you, what made you pen a second memoir? You did a first memoir, Build Me an Ark, and was mostly about your relationships with different animals. What made you want to pen another memoir?
I thought I would never do another memoir. I used to say, never say memoir. But I began to realize that I needed to take on human nature. I had taken on other animals and a lot of nature through much of my work, but I had never really taken on human nature. And we are such a self-referential species that I knew that we would all tune in, perhaps almost like a kind of stealth version of going through humans to get back to the natural world. So that was my first motivation. And my second was that I began to realize that I was a comic character, a picaresque character, that in the way that I found humor in many of the beliefs of the rapture that my relatives espouse, I also was a comic character. And when I had that, I think that sense of one's own divine comedy comes with age. I think when we're young, we're much more self-righteous, we're much more serious about ourselves. And as we get older, we begin to look at our mistakes and we begin to look at our triumphs and we have more of a detachment, a fond detachment. So it's almost like an omniscient narrator in one's own life. And I found that there were things I wanted to write about. that were still left. This is kind of Duck and Cover Unmasked. Duck and Cover was a novel about my family. This is the story behind the novel.
But I want to get into some of the details of it because it's such a great story, a great American story, so to speak. What would you say to listeners is as far as the benefits of writing one's memoir? What are some of the benefits?
That's a really good question, and many of my students ask that when it gets painful or arduous or strange. I think we always want to know, who am I? But when you write a memoir, you ask, who am I in this story? And you choose the frame of that story. I chose the frame of, who am I in this family? And I found, not to my dismay, I already knew this, that I was an outcast and a misfit. And yet I love them and they love me, even though I'm the first liberal in many generations. We've talked about the South and the far right, and we both have that tradition in common. And I wanted to look at who I became because of that tradition and that family, and then try to find who I will be, discovering my own spiritual path as separate from that family's tradition.
So as a writing teacher, you're sitting with someone, they might not be even going to publish it in some ways, or certainly it would be very unusual for a memoir. I mean, there are very few that reach the bestseller list. Your book is on its way, but that's a rare occurrence in a memoir, I must say, out of all the ones that are written. Yet it might be beneficial for us and to encourage people to write down their stories, don't you think?
Of course, reflection and self-reflection is the gift of consciousness. If we're always, I remember once a person said about another friend of ours, he's very perceptive, but he's not self-reflective.
And
I thought that was a really good distinction.
What do they mean by that?
Many people, because they need to survive, they need to achieve, are very perceptive about the world, how to work systems. And they can navigate that and actually do quite well. But whether or not they know themselves, that's the question. And memoir, you're the main character. I'm always surprised and laugh a little bit with my students when they are shocked to discover that they are the main character of a memoir and that the plot is the evolution of soul or self. And so they have to show up on the page. They can't just be watching everybody around them, as many writers do, the hidden observer. They have to turn that eye back on themselves.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it is then like, I've heard Alice Walker, who's a wonderful writer, how she says the characters then write themselves. Does this happen in memoir? Did this happen to you that you're in there and suddenly the I that's Brenda also starts writing herself in a way that's surprising?
I didn't realize how silly I was. And I didn't realize how many times I had taken a detour. Because, of course, I thought I was on the right path. I also didn't realize how, from my family's point of view, if you look outside yourself looking back in, how threatening I might be, like an invasive species. I mean, they're all pretty much the same, and suddenly there's this wild Venus flytrap or something in their midst, and they're going, kudzu, or, you know, what are we going to do with this invasive species? And looking at yourself from another point of view, I give this exercise that maybe your audience would like, those of you who want to do a memoir, which is to create 3 one-page exercises. And the first is writing from the point of view of someone who loves you, using the I. So I would choose my best friend saying, I love Brenda because blah, blah, blah. And the next is the exercise, someone who hates you. Now, that's pretty toxic when you actually get out of your point of view, look at another person's point of view back at yourself. And then the third page is someone who needs to understand you. Because when people need to understand you, they go the extra mile and they reach out and they get out of their own limited I call it the elevator speech. You know, when you're trapped in an elevator with someone, oh, I'm going through a divorce, and you're, oh, no, 13th floor, 15th floor. That kind of person, when they actually look at you with a need to understand, that's the beginning of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these exercises, I do custom-made exercises for every memoirist I work with. And I always say to them, you will discover the meaning of your life when you do memoir. You may not be rich or famous or happy, but you will discover that it all makes sense because you will begin to see patterns and a narrative arc about your own story that you can't see when you're trapped in first person.
And do you find with your with your clients or with your students, do you find many of us think we know the outcome? We know, oh, I know the meaning of my life. And so we start writing the memoir and we know where we're going. And do you find that it mostly takes us on another trip down a very different river than we thought we were on?
Yes, it takes you to places that are mysterious and surprising and uncomfortable. I always assign everyone this phrase. I did not realize that I was a blank, blank, and blank. And I happened upon that phrase when I was doing a chapter in the Old Testament part. This book is divided between Old Testament and New Testament, the Old Testament being a little darker, the New Testament having a little bit more epiphany, and I hope, grace and light. And I wrote as a child when a Sunday school teacher looked at me very puzzled, and I realized that I was a very wild, odd, and unknowingly subversive child. So when I give that assignment to my students, they at first they'll kind of stay in their point of view and they'll just say good things about themselves. But usually they'll come to a point where they'll realize, oh my goodness, I didn't realize I was this. And that's another gift of memoir.
That's definitely a gift. And there is another exercise that you give to your students that you mentioned in the book, which I just adored. And that was the exercise of whatever they're writing, they cannot kill off their characters. And what was the purpose of that exercise?
I love this story. When I was a young teacher, a writer in residence at Arizona State University, I began to realize that every one of my students were writing stories in which their main characters died. It was like Pac-Man. And this was before video games, so it wasn't an influence of that. It was just, it's easier to write a death scene. It's easier to kill someone if you can't figure out what to do with them. So I said, all right, enough death. For this semester, none of your characters can die. They have to live on. And that means you have to come up with strategies of survival. You have to come up with basically non-rapture, non-escapist, non-death plot. And everyone was very, very upset because it's so much easier to kill off a character.
You know, I really had that experience with a very famous writer, and you might know of this. It was the one who wrote The Horse Whisperer. And I'm very much a horsewoman, and when at the end of that book, oh, I hope I'm not giving away to people, he kills off the main character, I thought, that doesn't make sense to his own character. It was the only thing, and in the movie, they didn't do that,
right,
which was, I think, the better ending, because this guy couldn't possibly. It was like a cop-out.
Yes.
In my opinion. We'll talk more about all of this in just one moment. I'm here with Brenda Peterson, and she's the author of I Want to Be Left Behind, Finding Rapture Here on Earth. And if you'd like to be in touch with her, she has a website. It's of the same title, iwanttobeleftbehind.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. My name is Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. here with Brenda Peterson, and she is the author of a memoir, I Want to Be Left Behind, Finding Rapture Here on Earth. Brenda, this book is really, how did you avoid, you grew up in a fundamentalist or evangelical Christian family, Southern Baptist, but somehow you were immune to the dogma of the religion. How did you avoid that? How did you not get indoctrinated?
I asked too many questions to begin with. There's a story in the first chapter about being bounced out of vacation Bible school at the age of, I think, 9, because the teacher kept telling us that animals had no place in heaven, which I could not believe. I did not want to be in a heaven without other animals or forest or mountains. I didn't want to be in mansions. Who wanted a mansion? I wanted the Salish Sea. I wanted mountains. So that was my first question that kind of got me in trouble. And the second was, she kept harping on about the fact that we were not in this world. We were of this world. And that God was super above this world. And that he really wasn't here. So I thought, if he's not here, are we abandoned? And I started asking all these questions, and she basically kind of said, God's busy. So,
and you were how old?
I was about 9.
9 years old. So you tell a 9-year-old, well, God's busy. He's too busy to be with you.
For your little problems.
For your little problems, right.
But then, at the end, in the middle of the class, she suddenly threw herself down on the grass and asked us all to get on our knees and pray to God, because her contact lens had popped out of her eye. And I didn't. I sat there and very stolidly said, God's busy.
Where did you get the gumption to say that to her? It's just amazing that, I mean, you're figuring out something in your head. You grew up at least the first, 4 or 5 years?
5 years.
5 years in the forest, really. The forest was your companion.
Yes.
You were the oldest child, so
yes.
Did you have a baby brother?
I had a baby brother who was 7 years younger. And
so he was really a kid.
He was, yeah, very. But I write in the book this big epiphany that came from memoir, that the forest got to me before the faithful.
Ah.
And that, I think, is the deepest answer to your question, Justine, because before the belief systems came, I had thousands of acres of national forest up there on the border of California and Oregon. And we were a little tiny tribe of people, foresters, and just millions of acres. We just knew our perspective, which was that we were this small little species surrounded by this great, beautiful world.
Mm-hmm.
So when we ended up going to Harvard, following my father, who got a fellowship, we had to put shoes on, and we went back there and became civilized, so to speak. All these belief systems and all these constructs just seemed like that. They just seemed like ideas to be looked at and questioned. They didn't seem like something that had imprinted on me. And I think that nature keeps us from becoming dogmatic, because nature is not dogmatic. It's the ultimate in fluidity and diversity and adaptation.
Well, in writing this memoir, both of your parents are still living, and it's, tell me, has this strengthened your family bonds, or has it strained them? How is it with your family when you write about your family, especially your parents in this case, and your relationship with them? How has that been?
It's been a rocky road to a certain extent. The further right you go, the fundamentalist rage about this book is very intense. My parents are more moderate. They do believe in the rapture. They say things.
For people, what is the rapture?
The rapture.
How do they how do they view it, or as best you can say their view of it?
The rapture is an end times, it's about 170-year-old interpretation of the book of Revelations, that Christ is coming back and he will take the chosen righteous few up with him to heaven to kind of sit out the 7 years of tribulations that the rest of us sinners will endure until the second coming of Christ. So this idea of rapture, it's the fastest growing religion in America. There's something like the statistics, 1 in 3 people are born again Christians. There's a percentage that was in this article that was written about me that said, growth since 1990 of non-denominational Christians, often rapture Christians, 4,000%.
Wow.
So it's a huge, I mean, the statistics are in this country that only 39% of people believe in evolution and 55% believe in rapture. So when you have that kind of a philosophy that's only 170 years old, and it's really, the word rapture never appeared in the Bible. It's just an interpretation that lends itself to troubled times. Apocalypse is always easy when you think that you are going to escape the troubles here below. So my family believes in the rapture. My father says very clearly the Bible is very clear on this issue. And I say, but I don't believe that. So it's been a rocky road philosophically for some members. My parents and I have kept talking through all of it. I talk with them every Sunday. They got the first copy of the book. They're still
reading it. What was their response to the first reading of it?
They're still in the Old Testament section.
They can only read it little bits at a time, huh?
They've read like the gray whale section.
Uh-huh.
I actually took my parents to Baja, and that was a really wonderful time. We didn't talk politics.
Right,
we didn't talk religion.
Right. Well, I have to disclose that I was on that trip with Brenda and her parents, and got to enjoy a wonderful time, and it started off I knew how tense you were to invite your parents down to another whole tribe of people that were progressive, that were not into the rapture. I don't know of anybody else in the group who was into the rapture. And so I knew that you were, as it came closer and closer, you sent some emails out, oh my gosh, what have I done? And I knew that you were tense about it and how your family would fit in with this group.
But that you're being very modest, Justine, because she was my hero audience, listeners. In the tiny plane, and this scene is in the book, in the tiny plane, my father started in on, it was during the election, and he started in on how Carrie didn't know anything, basically. And I said kind of quietly, I thought we should have no politics, no religion this trip. You know, we're out here in the wild and we're going to see gray whales. And Dad just ignored me and kept on speaking. And then Justine leaned forward in this tiny little plane and she said, Max, we said no politics, no religion. And my father, he looked like he needed a parachute. You know, he kind of sat back and I was just thinking, oh no, this is it, this is it. But then 5 minutes later, he was laughing with you.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And I could tell that he was surprised by my sticking to that, because I knew that otherwise he would just be expounding the whole time about his political beliefs and not listening to anybody else. And we had been down there before. We actually had not been talking about politics down there. It was just a time to be in the natural world. It didn't even have electricity. It had maybe a generator that ran during the day while we were out on the water. But it was really a time to be totally in nature. And your parents know how to do that really well, don't they?
They do. And bless their souls. Remember that I was born in a Forest Service cabin with just the two of them as the oldest, and we had several years with this trinity in wilderness. So what happened that trip, which was a holy trip for me, is that we fell back into that original triangle of wilderness and happy family. And we had many years after that of great peace, because of no politics and no religion, which is something I would recommend for many family reunions.
One of the things that you did in your book that I just thought was a marvelous insight, and this is later on, you're much older, and you go down to a Bible missionary institute or something down in Arizona, Glorieta Cathedral.
New Mexico.
And the insight that you got there was so profound. You wrote about how God's church as a stronghold against the winds of chaos out there, or temptation or sin or whatever you want to call it. And you really, there was such compassion. I felt such compassion as you realized how people who are thinking that way and need to be in this physical structure, that life for them is an ever-present danger.
Yes.
And you really, I felt your heart feel empathy.
And remember, we go back now to memoir, and one of the gifts, whether you publish or not, is empathy. Because you see, I was sitting in that church, which was frightening to me because it was 1,000 people all believing in the rapture and, you know, the fellowship of the believers, and I was again a misfit. But I was sitting next to a young woman from the South, and I realized that inside the church, she felt safe and blessed and completely at peace with the divine. I feel that in nature. And so it's the same thing. You know, wherever you need to go to feel that oneness with spirit, I just don't think you should strong-arm other people, either as an environmentalist or as a fundamentalist, into believing or going to your own church.
In fact, you write about that, you know, when you were working much later for REI up in Seattle. And you write about how you took a piece of paper and you divided it into environmentalist and zealot environmentalist and zealot religious, Christian religious people.
Yes, and it was shocking, Justine, because here I was an environmental writer. I'd been doing a lot of work and also not liking any dogma. And I began to see that there was a dogma and a similarity. And I made this notepad just to kind of jot it down. And on one side was fundamentalists, on the other was environmentalists. And the list was the same: enraptured by doom, apocalypse now, fear of future consequences, righteous anger, thou shalt not, holier than thou, humorless, blame, evangelical. And when I saw that, I went, oh, I have to be very careful to try to find a middle path. Because anytime you polarize, you go into a place of judgment and you lose any chance of listening, deep listening, as you call it.
Yes, yes. I'm here with Brenda Peterson. She's the author of I Want to Be Left Behind, Finding Rapture Here on Earth. My name is Justine Willis-Toms, and you're listening to New Dimensions.
Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Brenda Peterson, and we're talking about memoir and what it means to write one and